So just a couple of quick words of introduction. I was saying on the first day of this that one of the things that was a bit of an innovation at the International Council meeting in Badger was starting the day with a bit of study. And it was, I thought, remarkable the difference that it made to the kind of quality of the meeting, the feel of the meeting, and even I think the discussions that followed it. I think the business, single inverted commas, went more smoothly for being placed so clearly in a kind of spiritual context. So we wanted to carry that on. We had a number of suggestions about what we might study, what we might look at on this event. But again, because we were so aware of the anniversary of Banti's death coming up, Banti was very much in our minds. We thought to focus on Banti would be quite an appropriate thing. A wee bit of a digression, but I was doing a bit of study myself on the Living with Awareness book, and there's a really, I think, fascinating discussion in that about Sampajanya, and sort of Banti talking about kind of sustained awareness, and he was talking about when you look at the pattern of your life, quite often what you see is an unfolding pattern that you're not always conscious of. It's almost you discover what it is that your life's trying to become when you look at the overall shape of it. And I think that idea of a life pointing to something deeper, a sort of deeper pattern trying to unfold itself, trying to express itself, I found that very evocative. Anyway, what we came up with in the end was looking at key moments in Banti's life, and they're significant in themselves, but also significant in that I think they touch chords that have meaning for all of us. So we decided to take a few kind of key themes from Banti's life. We had plenty to choose from, but in the end what we decided to go with was the going forth and the going for refuge, the first connection with his teachers and receiving practices, the impetus behind setting up the order and the movement, and then implications after Banti's death. He had a little less to say about that, obviously, but with the sort of looking at that as the fourth element. And we roped in Vidya Devi at kind of short notice, like being able to email Vidya Devi is like being able to email Ananda. If you want to know what Banti said, Vidya Devi was just immersed in it, and we asked her to suggest some texts. She came up with a few options, and what we're doing is just doing a little bit of a selection from some of the texts that Vidya Devi suggested, and over the next few days looking at texts that Banti on the whole has written, sometimes from a more personal point of view, sometimes from a more sort of principial point of view, trying to explain what he was doing, and just looking at some of the implications for the order movement and even some of the implications for us as practitioners. So kicking off this morning, we have Sagaloka talking about going forth, going for refuge, and the Diamond Sutra might even figure in there somewhere. So Sagaloka, thank you.
So it's 1942. The Second World War is raging, and young Dennis Lingwood, still a teenager, is working for the London County Council, reading avidly, and in love with a strawberry blonde girl working in the same offices called Sonia, who's 22, a little bit older from him. And amongst his reading was a book he discovered that included the Diamond Sutra and the Sutra of Wai Leng. So in the history of my going for refuge, he wrote, "Speaking of my initial response to the Diamond Sutra, I wrote, though this book epitomises a teaching of such rarefied sublimity that even arahants, saints who have attained individual nirvana, are said to become confused and afraid when they hear it for the first time, I at once joyfully embraced it with an unqualified acceptance and assent. To me, the truth taught by the Buddha in the Diamond Sutra was not new. I had known and believed and realised it ages before, and the reading of the sutra, as it were, awoke me to the existence of something I had forgotten. Once I had realized that I was a Buddhist, it seemed that I had always been one, and that it was the most natural thing in the world to be one, and that I had never been anything else. So there is more in the extract that you'll be given, but that's the that contains the essential. So we could say this was the arising of Bhante's path of vision, and the rest of his life was really a working out, an unfolding of that at ever deeper levels in a path of transformation. So that arising of the path of vision for Bhante was quite dramatic, and I think it was then reflected in the extraordinary life that followed. And yes, as Dharmarati said, we're going to be looking at Bhante's life and writing, and through that seeing if we can see, understand what it means to live a spiritual life, a life in the Dharma. And also look at it, how it unfolds in our own experience. With that, perhaps begin to see something of the archetype of the path. So, if you've read Bhante's biography, autobiography, we know that reading of the Diamond Sutra and the Platform Sutra, they were the culmination of a long process. It wasn't just an accident that he picked up those books. He was led to them through a whole series of other books and explorations. There was still a lot of working out to do, but a turning point had been reached. So we can ask, is there any echo of that experience of Bhante's reading the Diamond Sutra in our own life and experience? It may not have been almost... probably for most of us, wasn't anything like as dramatic or certain, but it can still have been very real. And I think back to my own student days. I'd explored social work after leaving school, before going to university. I'd done voluntary work. I'd been into politics, into demonstrations and all the rest of it, drugs and rock and roll. And none of those quite seemed to be satisfactory. And then I began to discover Eastern religion. I read Alan Watts' Way of Zen and books by D.T. Suzuki and Lama Govinda, amongst others. And there was a definite shift took place from a sort of angst-ridden existentialist sort of philosophy that this human life was basically flawed. There were moments of love and beauty, but basically you were making the best of a bad job. That was the sort of philosophy I'd come to. But then out of this reading came a much more optimistic sense of the potential for love and wisdom in all human beings. And something in me just said I had to follow this this potential, this glimpse. It was still very naively understood. I can remember sitting in my bedroom sort of just making a commitment in myself to love and peace. That was the best I could do at that time, but it was very real. And I think it's very important to recognize these turning points in ourselves and value them, and also see them and support them in others. Even where it's still just a dimly felt sense that there must be something more in life. That is something very significant and important to be encouraged and nurtured. That's what can bring people through the doors of our centres. And yes, of course, there's an echo, as well as an echo in Bhante's reading of the Diamond Sutra, echo in the four sights of the Buddha. He's seeing old age, sickness and death, and seeing that wandering holy man and realizing this is where I have to go with my life. So that's the first area for thinking about in this morning's discussion. So Dennis Lingwood was then drafted into the army at 19 and went off to India and Southeast Asia. And at the end of the war, there was a going forth. He left his old life behind decisively. He walked away from the army and began the life of a spiritual searcher with his friend Banerjee. Banerjee taking the name of Dharmapriya and Banerjee the name of Satyapriya. And eventually this led them to go forth as homeless wanderers. And again, that lovely section where he describes his leaving of Kaushali. There was only one way out. Religious societies, organisations and groups, far from being a help to spiritual development, were only a hindrance. However lofty the ideals with which they were founded, they had a natural tendency to degenerate in the hands of selfish human beings into instruments for the acquisition of money, position, power and fame. Instead of trying any longer to work with them, we would follow the example of the Buddha and sever at one stroke our connection with an incorrigible world. We would renounce the household life and go forth into the life of homeless wanderers in search of truth. For the last few months, we had only sat hesitatingly on the shore of the vast ocean of the spiritual life. Now, casting aside all fear, we would plunge boldly in. Tibetan Buddhists believe that the appearance of a rainbow is one of the most auspicious of signs, and the biographies of their saints and yogis are replete with references to this phenomena. Whether our going forth on the 18th of August 1947 may be considered an auspicious event, I cannot say, but it was certainly signalised by the appearance not of one, but of scores of rainbows. As we left Kaushali, it was raining. But as in the course of our descent, we emerged from the clouds into the bright sunshine below. We saw arching the road at intervals of a few dozen yards, not only single but double and triple rainbows. Every time we turned a bend, we found more rainbows waiting for us. We passed through them as though through the multicoloured arcades of some celestial palace. Against the background of bright sunshine, jewel-like glittering raindrops, and hills of the freshest and most vivid green, this plethora of delicate, seven-hued rainbows seemed like the epiphany of another world. So this was Banti and his friend setting forth, going forth. Again, very dramatically, probably again more dramatically than most of us have ever managed to go forth. But there is again something very essential in this going forth, this movement away from samsara to nirvana, or sometimes spoken of away from a samsarizing way of being into a nirvanizing way of being. In various question and answer sessions, I've heard Banti say that, talking about ordination, order members will maybe saying, we're not so different from anybody else, are we? We're Buddhists, but, we're not so special. And Banti's saying, well, no, a difference must make a difference. If you've gone forth, if you've gone for refuge, then a difference must make a difference. Buddhism isn't just, if you like, this spiritual icing on the cake of a good life, as it can be for people in the West. Buddhism actually must make a real difference to how we live, how we go about our life. And this outer going forth, this outer letting go and giving up, is obviously intended to support an inner going forth, a letting go of self-clinging, of grasping, aversion, ignorance, that that go with it. Again, there's that very telling line in the Dasadhamma Sutta, the 10 dharmas that should be reflected on again and again by one who has gone forth. And the first of these, the Buddha says, I am no longer living according to worldly aims and values. This should be reflected upon again and again by one who has gone forth. I am no longer living according to worldly aims and values. This should be reflected upon again and again by one who has gone forth. So, yes, something for us all, I think, as order members, to reflect on again and again. You know, has our going for refuge, our going forth and going for refuge, has it made a difference? You know, what is that difference? What have we left behind? What are we leaving behind? So again, this inner going forth and outer going forth. What is our practice of renunciation? It's often, I think, an uncomfortable question to ask ourselves. Again, I remember Bhante in question and answer sessions, discussion, saying in young people, the biggest distraction from the spiritual life is often sex and relationships. But in older people, as we get older, the biggest thing we need to look out for is settling down. You know, just getting comfortable, making a comfortable life, Buddhist life for ourselves. You know, very worthy, doing lots of good things, but somehow it loses that spiritual edge. It loses that spiritual dynamism and cutting edge. And to the extent we find stability, security, a sense of identity in things, career, status, other people, views, to that extent, we're not going to be able to make that really deep inner shift of letting go, that real going forth from a sense of a fixed sense of self, of me, mine, myself, sitting at the core of the universe. So then, going for refuge. Just one other point around going forth. Just emphasising the importance and value of the long ordination retreats at Gukhyaloka and Akashavana. Just the value of those long retreats as an outer going forth. That, you know, just gives us a real chance to reassess our lives and what matters most in life, away from our everything that usually holds us in a particular shape and particular way of being. So then, going for refuge, which puts the ritual seal on the momentum and direction in our lives. Again, if we read in the Thousand Petal Lotus, it's quite telling. But the most significant and influential people that Bhante met in those searching years were mostly Hindus of one sort or another. You know, he was involved with the Ramakrishna mission with Ram Dass and other very notable and remarkable teachers in southern India. And he was mostly disappointed with the Buddhist monks that he'd met. Yet he knew he was a Buddhist and he wanted to be ordained as a Buddhist. And he set himself on course to become a Buddhist monk, a bhikkhu. And he really tested himself. There's this interview with Stephen Batchelor for Tricycle, where he talks about how he set out to test himself before getting ordained. And Banti says, at the time it didn't seem unusual at all. I was quite unconscious of being one of the first Western Buddhists to take monastic vows. It seemed like the natural culmination of a whole series of developments that went back to my realization a few years earlier that I was a Buddhist and always had been. I simply thought that to devote oneself to Buddhism meant being a monk, being a full-time Buddhist with no other interests. But I also realized it would be a very demanding life, and I wasn't sure whether I was capable of it, so I wanted to test myself first. So then this whole period of wandering, testing himself, and again, it's something perhaps for us to think about. How far do we test ourselves? You know, how far do we really test ourselves in our preparing for ordination and as order members? You know, do we really allow ourselves to be really challenged? I guess it goes along with this thing of settling down. And yeah, there was this whole dramatic journey, final journey. You know, when Banti first asked for ordination at Sarnath, he was refused. The monks were very suspicious of him and his friend, and so they set off on that journey to Kusinari through the intense May heat. In his in the Thousand Petal Lotus, he speaks of walking through a curtain of fire to Kusinara, where the he was eventually ordained. So I just find that little section where he talks about the concluding stages of our journey were the worst, and had it not been for the hope that every step was bringing us nearer to the goal of our desires, it might have been difficult for us to carry on. It was early May, and the heat, having risen in a fiery crescendo to its terrific climax, now seemed likely to remain there indefinitely. Not a drop of rain fell. Day by day, the hot, dry wind from the desert, laden with dust, blew more strongly and scorchingly than ever upon the hard, sun-baked earth, which by this time had become crisscrossed with a network of innumerable cracks and fissures, some of them several inches wide. Travelling through the less hot hours of the day, and taking advantage of every scrap of shade, grimly and wearily, Satyapriya and I plodded from temple to temple and from ashram to ashram, mile after mile across the heat-stricken land. So that was Banti's final journey to ordination, and his becoming initially a Shramanera, a novice monk. And at Kusinara he was accepted by Uchandramani. And he wrote, "Whilst the ceremony was in progress, I experienced an extraordinary sense of peace, satisfaction, fulfillment, acceptance and belonging. It was a feeling such as I had not experienced before, and in subsequent years I was never surprised when an elderly monk told me that receiving his monastic ordination had been the greatest experience of his whole life. This feeling, it is impossible for me to doubt or deny. Since reading the Diamond Sutra and the Sutra of Weileng some 8 years earlier, I had been, on the next sheet, very much on my own as a Buddhist. I had certainly been on my own as a Buddhist in the army, whilst my 2 years as a freelance wandering ascetic had been spent in a Hindu environment with a companion who was oscillating between Buddhism and Hinduism. But now I was no longer on my own. I had been accepted into the Sangha or Buddhist spiritual community, was a member of that community, belonged to that community. My heartfelt desire not just to be a Buddhist, but to have the fact that I was a Buddhist recognized and appreciated by other Buddhists had at last been fulfilled. I felt satisfied and at peace. So, actually, I think that was Bhante writing about his bhikkhu ordination rather than his shramanera ordination 18 months later. But again, just the significance and importance of ritually, ceremonially making that commitment and just remembering the significance of it in our own life and really taking, you know, remembering again the importance of it for those we see ordained or those we ordain ourselves. That there's something irrational, unreasonable, deeply compelling about that need to commit oneself. Again, I remember on my own ordination retreat in Tuscany, the sort of rumour started to spread that some people might not get ordained on that retreat. It was the very first retreat. Things were still very experimental, and two people didn't actually get ordained on that retreat. And I just remember feeling very strongly something in me had to go for refuge. I didn't actually mind not having a kesa or a name or a sadhana, but I had to go for refuge. It was, it's not rational, but it's something very deep in us that just has to make that commitment. And then also just not simply, it's not just something we do for ourselves, because we can sit and do that in our own sort of room or quiet, make that commitment, but it's having that commitment witnessed, seen, and stepping into a community of others who've also made a commitment like that that seems so important, so significant. And I think again it's worth us dwelling on that, coming back to that, reflecting on that. It's something certainly Bhante continued to reflect on again and again after his ordination. It came out in his writings, you know, in things like his reflections on the levels of going for refuge, in the founding of the order, in the history of my going for refuge 42 years ago and so on, was the Buddhist bhikkhu. And it's something we continue to explore, you know, just the real significance and meaning of committing ourselves. So more of that will probably be looked at over the next few days, but today the focus is on the ritual meaning and significance of ordination, of what happens when that deep urge in us is recognized, witnessed, affirmed, which is just so key, central to our order and community. Yeah, it just seems worth returning to again and again.